Welcome to the Tracking Connections podcast, and thanks for listening.
We feature voices from around the world sharing stories of working intentionally with deep nature connection in ways that transform lives, families, projects, and communities. I'm Sarah.
I'm Aiden.
And I'm John.
And we are your hosts from Living Connection First.
Hello, everyone. Sarah here.
Hey, everybody. It's Aiden.
Hi, it's John. And we're here with Dr. Bill.
Hello, everyone. Nice to be joining.
So this is our second visit with you, Bill. If you might remember, some of you, that in episode 21, Gravity in Motion, back in July of 2024, Bill and I got together to talk about some interesting principles that, you know, went on a wide-ranging and very, you know, deep sort of complexity conversation, because Bill is very much into complexity medicine, and he's been a martial artist for many, many decades. He's works with indigenous healing, he's worked with the San Bushmen, and he's a medical doctor. And Bill has such a huge sort of range in his experience and his knowledge and his ability to bridge. It's really, really fun to have you on again, Dr. Bill. And Bill and I have been friends. Well, we talk weekly, and it's been years that we've done that. And it has led us into some really, really rich territory together. And so, you know, just before the holiday break, Bill and I were talking. It would be our last conversation before we broke for the holidays and the new year. And he said something to me at the end of our conversation where we were kind of looking at our work. You know, maybe, I don't know if we were intentionally doing this, but it was sort of looking back over the year, looking back over our lives, you know, thinking about, you know, our renewal processes when, you know, we go inside and we think about what we're doing differently in the coming year. You know, it's kind of common pattern. We had a episode on renewal with Sarah, me, and Aiden not too long ago. But I've been doing this process very intentionally for 25 years. And, you know, there's 8 steps to the process, you know, and I heard Bill say something at the end of our conversation. I asked him to repeat it 2 more times because it was one of those things where, like, I had told Bill at the time, like, if I had read those words in an article, I might have skipped right over them. This time, because it was Bill saying it to me, it had a different effect on me. It went deep somehow. It sort of struck something in my unconscious and caused a feeling in my being that I began to look into. What Bill was saying was, and let me frame this a little bit, because when I work with people, Sarah and I, Nate Summers, our Living Connection First Village, you know, and also for the last 40 something years, when we work with people and help facilitate nature connection into deep nature connection over time, people report that it had a healing effect on them. You know, so I don't always see myself in that light, you know, like that I'm a healer in some way. I feel more like a conductor or a mechanic, you know, offering tools right when they're needed. And these tools, that people take them and they do what they do with them on their own, you know, in the natural world around them, with other people, with themselves. And they have a progressive journey of sensory integration, expansion, connection. And yeah, they report healing, right? So this message from Bill, he says, the message of healing you bring to attend to individual and cultural wounding is paradoxically undermined or attacked by the very same wounding you would seek to heal. That's the statement that struck me deeply. That will also be in the show notes if you want to, you know, stare at it, because it gets deeper the more you look at it. And, you know, the immediate pattern that jumped to mind for me was, okay, yeah, that's right. So I remember one particular individual who recently visited Sarah and I. I was mentoring him since the age of 18, and now he's in his 40s and got some grown children and some young children. And, you know, he's an incredible naturalist and tracker, and has done a lot of professional work in serving wildlife projects and things. And if you walked with him today, if you were with Sarah and I and him when we were walking, you would get the sense that you were walking with a very deeply centered, really aware, very calm, very peaceful individual who was really paying attention on many levels. And it was just a pleasure for us to go on that walk where we were just investigating tracking stories, where we had found, you know, these tracks and this sign and so on. But if you had known him at 18, when I was working with him and he was extremely passionate about going on this journey and let me know that he would really appreciate my support, how many times during that journey I would offer him a tool innocently and he would rebel against that tool, or he would say he was going to do it and then he wouldn't. And then he would sort of come on the attack in a way, like being rebellious, being sort of intense. You know, that went on for several years with him until he found his own breakthrough. Something shifted in him. He went into a deeper state of humility, and I was no longer sort of, you know, an antagonist for him, you know. But remember, he asked me to help him. So that's, you know, that's sort of like an average experience. But sometimes it's not visible. Sometimes it's more insidious, in that there seems to be almost like a subconscious sabotage going on, you know, where there's some kind of inner rebellion that happens that the conscious mind is not even aware of. And I find that, you know, people rebelling against the very things that they're asking for, and maybe they're not even admitting they're rebelling against it. They might be saying, well, I was busy. You know, that was the one I heard the most. I was busy. So I'll talk a little later about why that hit me so hard, because it has something to do with me and not with these others. It has to do with how I received that rebellion. And yeah, it brought me to a really good place, and I'm just really grateful for that. So I just wondered, you know, Bill, like, what were you observing? What were you reflecting on? What were you seeing when you made that statement?
It's always interesting when someone throws back something that I've said, you know, that they throw back a quote to me. And it reminds me often what happens with my patients in psychotherapy. So a week later, a month later, a year later, 10 years later, all of a sudden they'll throw this quote. Oh, you know, Dr. Sutherland, do you remember when you said ... and often, you know, unlike this case, you know, which was sort of had a positivity to it, often they'll throw it back to me because they've been harboring some kind of misunderstanding or resentment, and they're holding on to it. And then all of a sudden they'll throw this quote back at me. And often is the case, as I don't remember, I'm like, oh, I actually don't remember saying that. But what makes it hard is that what they don't give back to me in that moment, they'll give me back the quote, but they won't give me back the context that the quote was sit in. You know, they've forgotten the whole hour conversation, what was felt, what they were going through in their life at that time. And so now all I have is this quote out of context. And that's a really interesting thing, because it's hard sometimes to understand, you know, what did I mean by that in that moment? And so what often ends up happening with my patients is, rather than telling them what I had said and why I had said it, I have to bring it kind of into the present space and say, well, I don't remember the context. You don't remember the context. So we give a chance then to look at these words anew, right? What does this line, what does this word, what does it mean now in this moment to you? And I think in the same way, I would kind of put that invitation out to all of us on the call today that, you know, in this moment, you know, what do those words mean? You know, what is the context in this moment that we bring to it that gives it meaning? And then I would also invite you, John, as we go along, to the degree that you know, remember what that conversation was about and can kind of bring some contextual aspects to it, I think that that's going to be useful on the call and response and the give and take of the conversation. You know, the other thing I would say, and this is kind of like a truism in communication, and this is I'm paraphrasing a quote here by a great complexity thinker named Heinz von Forster. And he said, the determination of the meaning of the utterance of what was said lies in the ears of the hearer, right? So that's also, I think, just really true. Like, I mean, I may say something from a certain perspective, but really what it ends up meaning is what you decided that it ended up meaning, you know, and how you hear and shape it. And so, you know, these words, these lines, these sentences that we put forth, they're participatory, right? Like the meaning isn't distinctly in themselves. It's how we meet them and shape them. And so I think that's going to be really important as we talk, to hear how you've taken that line and, you know, and how you've met and shaped it. The one thing that, you know, as I was trying to think back in memory to the conversation that we were talking about, in some sense, my statement about it was more in resonance with you as a friend, right? That because we share, you know, we have this ongoing Wednesday conversation and we shared a lot of different, you know, experiences and what's been going on in our life over the years. And so there's always a sort of a kind of a poignant sense of immediacy of how's my friend John doing, just like you received me in the same way, you know, how is Bill doing? So in some ways it was my bringing forth the quote in that way was less about the people that, you know, that may both try to receive and then reject it. But in many ways, I think I was speaking to a kind of empathy of, and perhaps a sympathy of how that's painful for you, you know, in the midst of this, that that when you have an offering, when you're bringing forth a sense of vision or a gift or a life's work to the world, something that you've, you know, a calling and a claiming that you've answered to, and that you've put in this, you know, you've put in the time and you've put in that effort to bring this forward, and that it's brought forward in a beautiful way, you know, one that's not meant to raise one's ego or promote oneself, but is an offering of the offering, you know, that the offering in itself is what's important, the relationships that it points to and it holds that what's important. I mean, a way you can think of this offering as a medicine, you know, as a kind of medicine, that it's the medicine itself that's important. And then that just what that feels like when, and I think it would be simple if it would just simply reject it. That's fine. You know, people can, we recognize in the world that people will choose or not choose to look at something, hold something, interact with something. So I think the simple rejection is not really ever the problem. You know, like we're not all things to all people. It makes that just normal in the world. And so, you know, other people will have attractions to other things and they'll say, no, that's not for me. And I think that's, you know, I think that that's relatively easy to accept. And of course, we have the same privilege. We say to other people, no, I'm, that's not my interest. That's not for me. I think, like you said, it becomes a little more painful when in some ways it is accepted, you know, when it is accepted and brought in. But then after that kind of accepting, that then there's this sort of raw rejection after the acceptance, you know, or like you said, a kind of some type of reaction to it. And it may be a reaction, like you said, in just sort of simple ways of a resistant non-participation. But sometimes it's a vociferous kind of attack, you know, where all of a sudden that it comes back that what was being offered is now being attacked, that it's becoming a source of contention or something along that line. And I think that's what I was sort of speaking to, that I could only imagine that when that happens, that it's painful because these things are offered up from a vulnerability, right? Like any vision is actually a vulnerable thing because it's a personal thing, right? You're saying this is my personal vision that I'm offering. And so there's an offering of a part of yourself in that. And so I think that's where that line came from. And I think that it too, if you look at it, if people take a chance to go back and read it, and maybe I'll just read it aloud once more. The message of healing you bring to attend to individual and cultural wounding is paradoxically undermined and attacked by the very same wounding you would seek to heal. And like I said, there's kind of a circularity in that. You know, you see that, again, there's at the very least irony, but more likely paradox, where, you know, the wounding that we'd look to treat comes back and looks to wound us. And in some ways, I think by analogy, it's almost like an autoimmune response in the body, you know, where at some point the body engages the immune system and somehow the immune system then looks to come back and attack the very same body that would look to support it. And so something gets twisted around there, you know, and the very fact that autoimmunity is increasing in our culture, like in our experience, that it's an epidemic, you know, of autoimmune conditions. It's in young people. It speaks in some ways. I think that it's kind of in some ways part of the same process of where is the culture at? Like, where is modernity at that we have such widespread illness? Certainly I see that in the mental health realm, but when you look at just the skyrocketing amount of autoimmune disease, it's a remarkable thing. And it's a remarkable amount of suffering for the people that go through it. So anyway, maybe I'll just leave it there for a second and let And kind of go back to that, like I said, the determiner of the utterance that's meaning lies in the ears of the hearer. So I put it back to you, John, to see like what did you hear in that moment? And not only what was the context in that moment that you heard it, but what has the context been since? What is the context right now that you're understanding it through? And maybe I just put that question back to you.
Yeah, well, thank you for all of that. And it was a really, really wonderful framing. You know, we were talking about at the very end of that conversation, my body of work, quote unquote, where I have, you know, since 1979, very intentionally collected, you know, what I'll just call tools. You know, you might call them elements. You can think of them as activities, things to do that can affect us both on the personal level, but also on the interpersonal realm level. So, for instance, you know, one of the tools that I like to speak about because everyone can relate to it is greeting customs. And I grew up in a place, New Jersey, on the, you know, the edge of New York City, where greeting customs were actually like spines or defense mechanisms. they were not used as intended, you know, like if you think from an anthropological perspective, you know, what is the purpose of a greeting custom? In a healthy culture, yes, there was greeting customs in New Jersey, but they were absolutely not utilized as intended. So, for instance, people would greet each other with, "How you doing?" And that is not an invitation to answer the question, "How you doing?" You know. So when I moved from New Jersey to the outskirts of Seattle, and I greeted somebody for the first time that I didn't know at a store with, "How you doing?" They actually started to tell me how they were doing. And I found myself like in a little bit of like a moment of shock, like, wait, what happened just now? You know, I didn't intend for that person to tell me their life story. You know, they're a cashier. And I realized, okay, I'm in a different place. The cultural element of the greeting custom, it doesn't have the same meaning here. In New Jersey, you would never dare to actually answer the question, "How you doing?" You would answer by nodding and saying, "How you doing?" You know, and you would probably get a "good" because everybody would say "good," or "that's another day in paradise," you know, or some cynical thing. But a well-wielded greeting custom has a particular design function, and that is to literally welcome somebody into a space, you know, whether it's on a Zoom call, I mean, literally, or a phone call, or someone arriving in person, where, you know, a well-received greeting custom. So if I'm the person who's knocking on the door, I might already feel anxiety. I'm knocking on the door. I kind of feel like I'm invading this person's personal space. And all this is kind of happening just below consciousness, but there's like a sort of discomfort, you know. And if the person opens the door and looks at me and says, "Hi, come on in," you know, but I can feel that they're not present, it's just going to continue to add to the anxiety, right? They may not show me the couch, or they may not offer me the bathroom or a drink of water. They just sort of leave me standing there in this awkward kind of way while they're busy doing something in the house. It's very uncomfortable, right? So when I look at culture, and I kind of picked up this perspective for many, many years of looking at cultural elements, I started to conclude, you know, in groups like the San Bushmen or my adopted family in Hawaii on the island of Kauai, traditional greeting customs have a very different effect, you know, where I'm walking up to complete strangers that I've never met before, but the way they greet me and the quality of their presence, the quality of their eye contact, I feel immediately loved. I feel immediately seen. I feel heard, understood. I feel like I am valued. I feel that I could actually contribute in this setting. I also feel a sense of belonging pretty instantly. You know, these are the five needs. So I think, you know, cultural elements, when wielded well, can literally change how a family shows up at the dinner table, just adopting a more intentional presence and, you know, intentional awareness of when we're greeting each other, you know, to really put down the pot and pan, to step out, you know, dry the hands and stand in full presence when the child arrives and to really feel them as they're entering and really look at them and to really greet them, which will change what that child's feeling and or the guest. And the same thing works on Zoom and it works on phone calls. You know, it's quite remarkable. But that's what I mean when I say in Bill's statement, you know, the message of healing you bring to attend to individual and cultural wounding. So, I wanted to make sure we understood what we meant by cultural wounding. So we adopt norms. The norms become normalized. Our society behaves in consensus around these norms. But those cultural elements that we've all agreed to, maybe even unconsciously, are not necessarily having a positive effect consistently on how we connect with one another. And the same is true of the personal individual tools. You know, okay, well, you know, one of the things that I consistently recommend to people is that they adopt a place close to their house that's, you know, in nature, that they can visit every day, even for just a few minutes. We call that a sit spot. Tom Brown called it the sit area. And it is foundational to developing nature connection. And it's one of the most potent tools there is. And yet how few people actually do it is really interesting to me, because I've had so many people who have embraced this practice tell me that that simple little thing literally changed their life. And yet people can't do it. And I can understand. I mean, I also offered to people because for some reason people cannot sit still. And that is probably the effect of a lot of collective wounding that is now unconscious that makes it very uncomfortable to sit still. Why am I sitting here? I should be doing something. This is really unproductive. This is a waste of time. You know, I could be doing other things. And am I doing this right? Is another one. You know, I don't know if I'm doing this right. I may not pass the test on the city area, you know. And that's maybe the mental chatter that is accompanying a person. And it certainly accompanied me when, you know, Tom Brown introduced me to this practice when I was 10 years old. I was completely resistant to it. And so he basically offered me a reward if I would do it by taking me to a really special fishing place to catch American eels, which I've always wanted to catch and never had the opportunity. So he hung that out as bait. And if I went every day until he told me I had gotten the message of what that exercise is about, then he would take me. And so I went day after day for many, many weeks. And in the beginning, I was bored. I was whacking at things with sticks. I was, you know, poking holes in the ground with a stick. You know, I was kind of like getting up, sitting down, walking around, looking. But I certainly was not aware. I was certainly not paying attention. I was certainly not present. But he knew that if I did this enough, I would actually get to a place where I suddenly discovered the magic of being present. And then the awe and wonder that accompanies that, which eventually happened. But it did take many weeks of doing that daily. And then at that point, I didn't need a reward. I actually wanted to do it. But, you know, he was smart enough to know I would rebel against it from the moment he saw me. He knew that I was antsy. You know, I had, you know, attention deficit issues. You know, I had all that stuff going on. So, you know, I just sort of want to kind of put out there these tools. But, you know, I just named two. I named a cultural tool and then I named an individual practice. But there's literally hundreds of them that we work with, and different tools are, you know, meaningful and helpful at different times. I think, you know, Bill, as you were saying, in the context, you're a sympathetic friend. You're really feeling for me the tiredness of offering these tools from a vulnerable place when a person seems to want them and then they reject them after they told me they wanted them. And this is what generates kind of at first confusion and then sometimes a feeling of hurt, you know, and that's been consistent, you know, for my life, you know. But what really struck me through this process, because as I said, when you said that to me, it wasn't just words. It struck me. There was an energy to it. And I think I understand that energy now more fully because you know me, you love me, and you have, you know, empathy for that struggle because you also experienced that struggle. And I think that's why I heard it differently. And that was an important distinction there that just came clear to me. But the effect that it had on me is it made me look back over the next couple of weeks, it was working on me every day. I was, you know, just, I might be doing dishes or outside doing some tending on our landscape. And, you know, I'd sort of have these intermittent emergences of scenarios in my life going back to when I was 19, when I first ran into somebody at college who read Tom Brown's book, which had just come out the year before, and said to me, "Oh, you were mentored by Tom Brown? I just read The Tracker. That's unreal. Like, wow, would you mentor me the way Tom mentored you?" And I was like, whoa, that's an interesting question, you know, and he was my roommate. And I thought, well, you know, I don't see why not. I'll give it a try. And I think that in that innocence, oh yeah, I know what to do. I know what Tom did for me. I can easily offer them practices to do and they could just do them. And I hadn't yet even realized that there would be resistance, you know, this paradox of the undermining and attacking of the very same wounding you would seek to heal. I that was not on my radar. So of course, what I did in my insecurity, when things didn't go well, and what I mean by that is if I offered them a practice like the sit area and they didn't do it, I interpreted that I wasn't good enough at wielding these. I wasn't a good enough person. Like, you know, I would kind of almost feel shame that it failed. Like, oh God, I'm not as good at this as I thought I was. Or, you know, Tom really knew what he was doing. I don't know what I was doing. And all that, that was internalizing in me. And I think what it did was it sort of muted my effectiveness. You know, I wasn't standing in the full understanding of the power of these tools and wielding them without concern, because I think I was taking it personally for many, many years. And I think that it caused me to really think about how the echo of that wound, you know, so I'm trying to help them, they're rebelling because of the wound they carry, it's coming back and it's hitting me and causing exasperation in my own wounds, you know. And I was like, wow. So I kind of diminished the power of my ability to help others by taking it personally, you know, and that was my big insight.
Wow. I'm really appreciating listening to the two of you. And I'm craving kind of a simplification of this concept of the paradox of, so the wound that we're trying to heal is undermined by that wounding itself. And I don't know, I want to put it in like a really simple context for people. So like if I burn my hand on the stove, I've created a wound now on my hand. And, you know, if I go to try to heal that wound on my hand, it's going to hurt, right? If I try to put some salve and put a bandage on it in my attempt to heal it, that wound is going to say, ouch, no, that actually hurts. And luckily, you know, we have the wisdom to know that, you know, that's a temporary pain and it's really good for us. We just need to touch it a little bit right now. And this, you know, in time it will heal. And we actually need to tend to it in order for it to heal. So bringing that into maybe a social context where you were talking about greeting people and the sense of welcome. And if I have a wound around, you know, a relational wound where people generally aren't nice, right? People aren't really safe. And I walk into a home, say, and someone comes to me with wide open arms and wants to embrace me. Every nerve in my body, if I'm in that place of people aren't safe, is going to, you know, be on end. Like this person's hugging me and you could see it, you know, come up like cynicism, resentment, or just pure anger or fear. Right? Where this person is walking with a wound of people aren't safe and walking into a warm embrace, right? Into a potentially healing situation. I mean, in order to heal, one of the ways we do that is to have that opposite experience, to have that healing experience, to remind ourselves, oh no, this person is safe. But can we overcome that part, that wound that's saying, nope, this person's not safe, not safe. You should not go into that hug. It's dangerous, right? That's that wound that's trying to say, nope, healing is not possible, right? Like, you should not go there, should not go into that hug when that hug is actually the thing that will heal that wound over time. I guess I'm looking for those bridges, right, of how do we overcome the learned experience that the wound is carrying in order to step into the healing process, to be able to say, oh, okay, that hug, that person's actually not trying to kill me. That person is actually trying to, you know, extend an olive branch. That person is potentially safe, right? And how can I step through this wound to allow the healing to happen, to allow myself to say, okay, not everyone is dangerous. I can be hugged and embraced and allow that pain to be felt and to melt away. And I think it's that pain, right, that informs us that don't touch the stove again, or don't touch the wound, don't touch the blistered hand, and don't allow yourself to be hugged because that's going to hurt, right? That there's eventually going to be pain if I've had, you know, social or relational wounding, relational trauma. There's going to be pain if I try to reconnect. So how can we build our awareness, build our own resilience, our capacity to be objective, right? To stand back from our personal experience, recognize that we're in a wound, that we're moving from a wound, and then have the courage, right? And the I want to say tenacity to say, okay, this is going to hurt a little bit. I'm going to have to probably cry and release some old memories and some really painful things that I've been, you know, wanting to avoid or not able to process to step into a place of healing.
I enjoyed what you were saying there, Sarah. I think, yeah, in some ways, I think there's a whole other conversation to be had on, you know, what do we mean by this? Well, but we use these words all the time, right? Like healing, like what is the nature? I think that's an entire number of conversations in itself, you know, as into what is the nature of healing. And I think I'll probably defer them to another time that we can have. The one thing that I think is the perspective that I'm focusing on is actually on the one that is giving up, is the offerer, like is the offerer and not the receiver. And so, you know, as you were talking, and one of the things I was thinking about is, we were talking about the response, right? Like, oh, that's painful, and there's a response from the system to that pain, or, you know, that's whether it's the body, you know, and it's burning, or the individual and receiving that hug. One of the things that I thought about there too is how that comes forward. Like, what is the nature of that energy? And so often what happens is we recognize that the offering is wise, right? Like tending to that burn, like that salve, that bandaging, that's wise. Or, you know, or that these, as John was mentioning, that these techniques like a sit spot or whatever the case, like that we can see that there's a wisdom to what these things are. And because they're wise, they're hard to argue against, right? Like it's hard to argue against the tending that's being offered. So because we know that they're wise and they're not really something that we can argue against, what I think is that there's this kind of lashing out at the offer of the offering, right? And that I think is sort of where, you know, sort of the dynamic where I think the sort of quote came from, right? Which is, you know, so I can't, what's being said makes sense, but so I'm going to attack the one that's the bearer of it. And I think that's where we have to sort of begin to look at that kind of response. Like, and we have that sort of that cliche, right? Like, don't kill the messenger, right? Don't kill the messenger. But why do we have that cliche? Because we're always looking to kill the messenger, right? We're always looking to lash out at the one that is offering something. And it makes sense because the offering in itself is watertight. You know, they're good things in and of themselves. And of course, that's never enough. There has to be, they're good things within the right timing, the right context. But of course, the offerer is always going to be flawed, right? Like the person, because we're human beings. So, you know, we're always going to be flawed in not what we offer, but in how we offer it. And I think that is the vulnerability that allows the other to lash out at us. And then the question is, well, how do we deal with that? You know, because, and often they're lashing out at our very woundedness, right? And I think that's an element that has to be brought in too, which is an awareness you know, when we're bringing these things forward, like, are we aware of our own wounding? And I like what John had said earlier, right? That, you know, that when his, in these early days, when his roommate was rejecting the offering, there was a taking of it personally. Oh, like, I'm doing something wrong, right? So, you know, so there's an igniting of that wound that's sort of within there. Anyway, that's just the thoughts that came out of what you were sharing there, Sarah.
At the risk of being a little bit too broad, I want to bring in our modern cultural context into the whole conversation, because the nature of the work of reconnection or of deep connection, well, and the nature of healing, requires us in its very process to go beyond the limits of our comfort and to go into places that are painful, that are difficult. And I think our culture has given us a story that's very different than that. That's a story of, you know, okay, there's school and yeah, you just have to go to school and, but you'll figure it out and you'll kind of find your way through school. And yeah, you don't want to do it, but you'll, you know, you'll get it. And, you know, and then the same thing with work. There's like sort of a lot of, you know, these necessary things that are unpleasant. But what we learn underneath that is we just sort of learn these coping mechanisms, and the coping mechanisms wind up turning off our deeper parts of our nervous system, turning off and masking the parts of ourselves that long to be fully connected and more deeply connected with the world around us. And, you know, I think it's Dr. Gabor Mate who talks about this idea of like, what is healing when your entire culture is toxic, when you're literally living in a toxic culture? And I, you know, I think about that with the context of the San people, because we have so much evidence that when connected people try to go into our modern culture, they can't cope with it and they have to retreat back to the, you know, the indigenous culture or the more connected culture. So we're attempting, and, you know, in the big picture, to go in the opposite direction, to start from a place of modernity and move towards a more connected place. And that's necessarily more sensitive. So I think there is something about the nature of this journey in particular that is more difficult. And I would say that it's likely that any deep journey we go on as people is going to require us to face this deeper part. And when I think about that in contrast to sort of our, you know, our ego's story or sort of the easiest stories that we want to tell ourselves, you know, that we just basically want to feel good and feel happy. And then we go, okay, well, maybe if I go and do nature, then I'll feel good. But it's, you know, then you go there and, oh, it's difficult and I'm bored and I'm struggling and I'm still here and all of my struggles are still here. I think that there is a letdown that happens there as well for all of us. We thought, oh, this journey that we picked, it's going to make me feel, you know, feel better from going on it. And that's true, but it's, you know, there's the truth of our healing is not this sort of simple salve, you know, or, you know, I like to think of like the idea of, yeah, you can eat candy that's easily available calories. That's sweet and satisfying, right? We get that dopamine hit or we get those easy short-term wins, but they're not lasting. That the work of transformation and deeper connection is necessarily painful and difficult at times. And I think that is part of the reason why it's so important to be doing this in community, to be doing this in relationship, and to actually create a container together that acknowledges that, that acknowledges sort of the deeper complexities and difficulties of the human experience and really just of the nature of healing and growth, that we are continuously finding our edges, moving beyond them, reaching a place of deeper connection, of deeper sensitivity. And also that is a precious thing. It is a fragile thing. And it is not something that our modern day-to-day culture is very well designed to support. So there's a lot working against us here, but if we can create containers together and contexts together that acknowledge that and acknowledge that challenge, we can go forward. But I don't know that that can be the responsibility of the mentor to hold that container as well as provide the wisdom, right? That seems like too much for one person to take on.
A thought came to mind, you know, from my older brother, Paul Rayfield, who's an adopted brother, an Odawa peacemaker. And he said, what we're talking about is simple, but it's not easy. You know, and in that statement is everything that has been said here so far. It just rolls up there, you know. Yeah, it's very simple. I'm just going to go outside and adopt that little place in my yard and go there every day. That's simple. But it's not easy to overcome all the resistances that have been mentioned so far. But yes, the container is the solution. I totally see that. I'm a big believer in that. And that's why, you know, we founded Living Connection First, because we understood that what we call going together will give an exercise that's a very simple tool, like a sit area. And then all of us who are in the village, who are listening to our, you know, Monday Musings, which is our, you know, internal podcast, hear that that's what we're going to do for the month. And now all of a sudden, somehow more people actually do it than would otherwise if it was prescribed in a one-on-one kind of a way. And then we all come together in these Zoom calls and we talk about it. And all of a sudden, the villagers themselves are talking about it and people are resonating with what's being said. And there's all these different and diverse voices making it this okay and safe. And so we get a much higher adoption rate when we go together. So, you know, the evidence is clear and practically clear in what we do. And it's working.
I really did appreciate there what you were saying, Aidan. And, you know, I think it's interesting because when I floated that the original quote, what I'm enjoying now, of course, is that we're looking to find a way to create a generalized meaning or discussion or point that's, you know, that we can see is how is this applicable broadly in this relationship that we call healing, how we attend to wounding at different levels, and trying to see you know, that we can find a generalized message or a point of wisdom. But I have to say that when I actually, you know, originally, and I'm feeling this now, like when I said it to John, of course, it wasn't in the general, right? It was speaking, at first I thought, you know, that I was speaking to John in his struggle, in his experience, in the repetitive ways that this comes around in our life. But like in all things, often too, when we put something like this out, we're speaking to ourselves, you know, I'm seeing again, like I said, a sympathy in John that lets me, that's resonating in me, you know, where I think of, you know, in his stories, I'm feeling all the time, you know, where there's been resistance to what I offered, to where there's been a rejection of my offering. And then there's a chance to feel into that, right? Into that. And of course, it's a double feeling because on one level, there is my own wound and its reactivity. That's one half of that paradoxical statement. I'm the one that's resistant. You know, I'm the one that's wounded. I'm the one that is rejecting the offerings of all of my teachings. So, and on the other hand, there's that, where I'm on the other side of the equation, where I get to be the offer. And of course, we get to be both of these things in our life, right? We're both sides of that equation. We're not just one. But there's a nice clarity when you realize that. So one is it helps to clarify, oh, this is like wounded stuff. And when I say wound, I mean, it's very easy. I mean, there's all this psychological terminology, and I'm kind of a little allergic to all of the psychological terminology. But when we use words like wounded or healing or trauma, I think more fundamentally, you know, we're looking at the tear of the web and the weave of relationship, which is, you know, could be potential in this beautiful whole. But like you said, in this modern world has become rent and torn in so many different ways, and we're trying to cope and live with those tears. So I can very clearly see when I'm in my wound, you know, when these come forward, and that helps me to learn to transcend and grow and find the spaciousness around that. But there's something else I think that's deeper than my wound in this, or deeper than John's wound, or deeper than any of our wounds, which is a legitimate kind of grief that's present in this moment, individually and culturally. And so when we talk about the San Bushman, like when I had that chance to be with them, I was like, oh, you know, this is, they're like John says, there was just something that was just so wonderful and powerfully true, being in their collective presence. And they're modern people too. I mean, they have been, you know, deeply affected by the modern world, but yet still there was this wonderful large remnant of a type of wholeness. And but in that very same moment of feeling all of that, there is this tremendous grief, right? Like, oh gosh, this isn't in my life. This isn't in my world. When I go back home, I'm going to have to face that again. And so there is a real grief that is bigger than any personal wound. And I feel that grief over and over as I see myself and the people in my life, you know, struggling. And sometimes that struggle looks like the rejection of the very same thing that would heal the grief. And then it becomes doubly grieving. But there is something very powerful and tangible here. And maybe grief is maybe we call that the collective wounding or the collective loss. I'm not sure at what level you see it, but there's something very palpable about that in the midst of all of this too.
It's like when you have this dream of, I'm going to become a musician and I'm going to go play, you know, all these incredible songs that I'm inspired by. And then you actually pick up the guitar and you go to play and you like can't even push the strings down and they're buzzing and everything. And it's like you're the reality of how far we are from what we are longing for can be so overwhelming that it's easier for us to just tell a story that must not have been it. And then to keep going rather than accept the reality of, yeah, the day to day is really different than what I see it could be.
And Bill, I've heard you say a number of times over the years, if we acknowledge and come from impoverishment, that's a really helpful step. Can you explain why?
Well, first, I think it's a kind of place of acceptance. Like we are in a deeply impoverished time, despite material wealth. When we look at all of the, you know, all of the deep connections that have been sort of rent and torn and the separation to nature, to others, to ancestry, to wisdom, tradition, to a world. This is, you know, modernity is an incredibly impoverished place. And often our reaction in that poverty is to, you know, covet the wealth of others. And I think that's so often why, you know, we'll run to other traditions, you know, with the hope of, you know, in some ways beg, borrowing and stealing, you know, or like, just give me something in this moment of our poverty. And that's understandable, you know, why that happens. But I've come to think about this poverty is in some ways, again, there's a paradox that there's a deep wealth once you accept a poverty, right? Like there's a kind of settling that can happen. And from poverty, there's nothing but potential, right? There's nothing about a kind of potential that we can start to step into. Poverty ends, you know, has a sense of offering the potential for a kind of creativity. And it's a necessary creativity because there's something very close, like, to poverty is survival, right? Like that this becomes a movement of survival, right? And at the beginning, it may very well be a kind of coping, you know, but there's a chance then, you know, to try to find a kind of stability, a foundation. But I think that there's a chance to go beyond it. And I'm not trying to glorify, like I'm using this in a kind of an abstract way. I'm not trying to glorify impoverishment. But if we are in an impoverished place, we have to start with an acceptance. And then what moves out of that? You know, what comes forth from that? And I guess in a sense, like poverty is like the artist's blank canvas. You know, there is a chance to say, well, okay, well, you know, how do we start to act and move and put strokes on this and see what kind of learning starts to come forward? And again, we know that because we've seen that in the work, right? When people do find a way, you know, to pick up these offerings that are present to us, like sit in this spot. I mean, it's such a simple thing. Like it is present to us in our poverty, right? Like nature still abides. We can go out there and sit in it, you know, that is open to us. That we know for a fact that a certain set of richness begins to flow from that if we can see to move into that very simple initial position.
I can pick it up there because I failed to answer half of the question that Aidan asked me earlier, which relates back to this. Should the mentor assume the responsibility of creating the container for those who are impoverished from, you know, cultural richness? If I come from, as Gabor Mate's description, a toxic culture. Well, I'm impoverished for connection to people. But we know that going together in a group will create a little bubble of positive connective culture, which will result in everybody moving, at least moving, you know, not rebelling completely. They might still be rebelling, but they can't rebel against a single person anymore because there's all their friends and village mates are going with them. They can't all be wrong. You know, I could easily make the mentor wrong because I can rebel. You know, I could go, oh, he's holding wisdom. I need to, you know, go against him, you know, that rebellion. But if everybody is doing it and even openly speaking to their resistance, and then they're moving through the resistance and the results of that, well, then it's like, okay, I think actually there's enough critical mass here. I can move with this. You know, it's a really potent formula and it does work. But should the mentor then be responsible for holding the container? And I think, you know, the answer is in the beginning, yes. You know, every time I've gone to a new community to help them adopt these tools and develop a team that can work with these tools, I've had to come in as a one-man container until two or three others could pick up the container. And then I help them to understand what it means to hold the container. And then they can start to hold the container. But there's a journey. You know, there's first the unawareness that a container is even necessary. I don't even know that I don't know that. But then there's the awareness that I don't realize that a container is important. And wow, when there is a container, it really works. And whoa, what is a container and how can I play a part in it? And then the practice of holding space, and then where that practice becomes embodied, you know, similar to the journey on the sit area where my first day at the sit area was complete rebellion. Like, I'm here, I'm doing it, I'm going through the motions, but I'm not really here and I don't really care. And I'm going to smack things with my stick and, you know, day after day after day after day until I find myself in the present moment and see something cool and start to find awe and wonder in an insect. And, you know, suddenly like it's timeless and I kind of don't even realize I spent so much time there, but I really enjoyed it. And then I do that enough where I start to realize actually that's a positive feedback loop for me. And I actually want that experience now. That's where it became embodied for me. And once it was embodied, that's when Tom took me fishing, right? So there is a bit of a journey for each of these tools to take root. But, you know, ultimately, the mentor can't hold the container for 9 billion people on the planet who might need it, or, you know, 7 billion, whatever it might be. The Bushmen certainly don't need me to hold the container for them. They've got that down. They all hold it, right? And it's beautiful. But it is important for the mentor in the beginning to realize that in order to be able to sustain and maintain without burning out commitment to a group of people, there has to get to a point pretty early on where the mentor is calling out the need for the container, the need for the people in that group to begin to see their role in it and to learn how to hold it as well. You know, and we use the 10 stones of connection for that. And, you know, those 10 little simple lessons, people at first are very mental about them. And then eventually they start to figure out how their style, their own personal way of meeting that, meets with these 10 tools, which, you know, end up blending as it becomes embodied so that there isn't really 10 separate things. It's just knowing how to hold a good space for others. That can be easily taught. And so to keep the mentor from burning out, the mentor has to be aware that the container of the group moving has to become the group's responsibility so that it can regenerate. Now, we call this regenerating connection circles. Like it's a very important process that prevents the teacher or the mentor from becoming the one person be all end all, which never works. It doesn't work for the mentor. It doesn't work for the people. Everybody needs something different, as Bill said earlier. So the more different voices, young, old, you know, men, women, other, you know, that all these different voices begin to strengthen that container, the more those people step into their embodiment of connection, the more beautiful and powerful the container becomes. And then the more tools you can put in that container and the more, let's just say, effective and efficient the journey is for everyone involved. So, you know, that's kind of my engineering mind here after 40 years of doing this, but that's what I see works. So
Well, I'm really appreciating the broadened look, Aidan. Thanks for starting that part of the conversation. You know, we're coming from that place of personal wounding and moving through and being within a, we could say, a wounded society in many ways, and especially if we're looking through the lens of nature connection, which is the focus of our work at Connection First. Nature connection and people connection, there's a huge wound globally around our connection to the natural world. And it's painful on so many levels, and it's been at it for thousands of years, really, and then sped up in the last couple hundred of years, our disconnection from nature. So there's this collective wounding, right, around deep relationship with the natural world. And it's interesting, you know, like John speaking to creating this culture where we're normalizing it, right? We're saying, no, it is okay. It's okay to be a nature person, you know. You are safe here in this tribe. And it's an amazing vision to be living in, creating that space where people connected to nature is good, and it is profound in its depth of experience and its power for healing. And so as visionaries, I think it's really important to hear this, what Bill was talking about. Like, sometimes he rebels against his own work being put out in the world. So, you know, when we have these really heart-centered callings of what to bring into this world, what we want to see more of, and then we see the world maybe not being ready for it, right? Maybe that awareness that, you know, we could be fully rejected if we stand in this place of our vision that of bringing something that's not the quote unquote norm, and you know, facing that like societal wound with an offering of healing, and having that awareness that, yeah, if I bring this, it could be highly likely that it's going to be rebelled against. But can we still step into that place as a visionary?
That was my big takeaway from what Bill said to me on December 18th. It was exactly that. Like, how have I compromised my own commitment because of my own wound? You know, how have I taken it personally, even unconsciously, but then moved from fear that I would be rejected, or that I'm not good enough, or that it won't work? And, you know, if we're bringing something that we really believe in, it's so important for us to be aware of how we're internalizing things. Because if we're not over our own wound, there's a lot of room for mischief. There's a lot of room for mischief. And it's not just coming from those who might reject what we're offering. You know, it's also coming from us. So I think this has been a really, really wonderful conversation. And I heard Bill say that maybe there's another conversation around the nature of healing itself, which would be, of course, interesting, and hope that we can get to that someday, Bill. And thank you, Sarah and Aidan and Dr. Bill, for making time for us in this conversation.
Just as we're coming into our wrap up here, I kind of want to leave with a bit of a contrary notion. You know, one of the, I'm still thinking about this notion of containment, and, you know, and one of the things that have been really rejected in modern times in medicine, in teaching, is this notion of paternalism. The doctor as the paternal figure that, you know, sort of the doctor knows best, this type of thing. But if we think about where that, the root of that word paternalism is, it's in parent, right? And there is a role and a time and place for all of us where parenting is a necessity, either in the receiving of that parenting or in the giving of that parenting. That child, as they reach out into the world and they're learning, is looking for that containment. They don't have a nervous system that can metabolize and handle all of these things. So they need a container that handles the overflow, that can help in the metabolism of feeling. And at some point, return that back to them when that body, with their being, is ready to start to hold what was too much. And when we think about wounding, I mean, wounding in many ways is a kind of delay of our development. It creates a type of immaturity. It sticks us in a certain place of life. And you mentioned the work of Gabor Mate, and he often will talk about these things. And maybe these woundings were very young, you know, within the first year of life or first years of life. And although we grow into adulthood in all of these many ways, there's a part of us that gets stuck in this kind of immaturity. And so it's contrary, but I think that there is a role, you know, for both in as individuals, as individual mentors, or collectively as groups, for creating, not forever, but for the right time and place, the necessity of a kind of parenting, a kind of remedial parenting that has to be done. And of course, it's to get away, you know, the notion of paternalism, getting away from it, was that we empowered the patient, that we gave them information and knowledge and choice and encouraged them to make those choices. And of course, that's what we're all heading for. That's what we all want for ourselves and for each other in our lives. But how do we get to that place that we're not just in reactivity, that the truth of those choices can actually become apparent, and that we can actually make them not just as a concept, but in a truth? Because when we're in reactivity and habit all the time, there really is no choice. And so, you know, there is something here in that too about, and again, not as an ultimate, but as a shifting kind of necessity and role. And you know, maybe that is something to look into a little more and understand the nature of that. And I'm very grateful for those figures that played the role of parent in my life, later on in my life, my teachers, you know, that have, and I'll say their names, you know, just to honor them, you know, Fabian and Clem and Brad and Okayama, and, you know, there's so many of these characters, these mentors, just like John speaks of Tom Brown. And I'm glad that they were there to parent me and hold my rebellion and hold my lashings and hold my resistance and even create space for me to reject them only to come back to them later, you know, with a head sort of bowed in a kind of humility. And I'm grateful that they were there to receive all of those things. And so I just want to leave with that, leave off then with that statement of gratitude for those that helped me in my healing in that way, via their offerings and also via their vulnerabilities and very human shortfalls. Yeah. So I'm just going to end with that and say thank you on that.
Thanks for listening to Tracking Connections. If you enjoy this podcast, it would mean a lot to us if you would take a minute to follow or subscribe. Following the podcast helps us, and it helps you, because you'll never miss an episode. We'd also love for you to give us a 5-star rating and review and share an episode with a friend. To learn more about our current offerings, visit livingconnectionfirst.net. We'll see you next time.